The cruel path of Cyclone Freddy, the longest-lasting cyclone system ever recorded, slams into Mozambique for a second time.
We saw roofs torn off of buildings, off of schools, off of hospitals, and off of people's homes.
Also today, dengue fever is a tropical disease that sickens tens of millions of people each year. Now it's spreading.
High-income countries are not safe from dengue anymore because of this climate change.
I'm Marco Werman, and while missiles fall across Ukraine, Ukrainians have not forgotten about dating and love.
Почему ты решил жениться сейчас, пока война?
This couple decided to tie the knot during wartime. They say they needed some good in their lives, especially now. And in Spain, a divorcee and the financial settlement a Spanish court agreed to for years of toiling for her family. All that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for making it here today. The weather, always something to talk about. We've seen storms hammering both coasts of the U.S. Around the globe, there's extreme weather. In some places, extreme seems to be on the repeat cycle. The same storm, Cyclone Freddy, revisited southern Africa for a second time. It's claimed more than 100 lives in Malawi and Mozambique. For at least one family in rural Mozambique, rushing water ripped their home apart. Finally, the roof collapsed and the walls floated away. Guy Taylor has been witnessing the wrath of the cyclone up close. He's a spokesperson for UNICEF and joined us from the Mozambican capital, Maputo.
We were on the ground when the storm hit, and that was a pretty terrifying experience. Extremely strong winds following rain the day before, and then very heavy rains in the days preceding as well.
So, yeah, help us understand the strength of this storm, Cyclone Freddy. What have you seen that really gave you a sense of this monster?
Well, when we came out on the morning after the cyclone, we saw many, many trees down. Many had fallen also on buildings. We saw roofs torn off of buildings, off of schools, off of hospitals, off of people's homes. And then when we ventured out into the surrounding countryside, I think the situation was even more serious there. Many people obviously living in quite rudimentary housing and structures built of wood, built of mud and adobe in some cases. Many of those have been completely destroyed and also very seriously affected by the flooding.
Yeah, as to that flooding, I gather many, many houses have been washed away. What do these mudslides look like?
The latest figures, which were released just a couple of hours ago, suggest that more than 16,000 homes have been partially or fully destroyed. So quite widespread devastation.
So 16,000 homes destroyed. Is that concentrated in one place? Or, I mean, give us a sense of where you've touched down in recent days and what you've seen.
This was in Kelimani, which is the city on the eastern coast of Mozambique in the province of Zambezi, where the storm made landfall and in the area surrounding that. So in addition to those 16,000 homes, there were around 600 classrooms which had been partially or fully destroyed, which is a huge concern for us at UNICEF. Obviously, children being cut off from education for potentially prolonged periods of time. We're also very worried about the risk of an exacerbation of the cholera outbreak, which the country has been facing since September last year. Currently, around 8,500 cases of cholera have been reported. And obviously, cholera is a waterborne disease, so there's a very real risk of that being made worse.
Right. So Cyclone Freddy, as I indicated earlier, it's the longest-lasting cyclone on record and falls into what meteorologists are calling a loop trajectory. Guy, I know you're not a weather expert, but I'm wondering if you've come upon this phenomenon and what it means as we look a few days or weeks down the road.
It's pretty clear that Mozambique is really bearing the brunt of extreme weather and of man-made climate change. Mozambique is hit, well, on an annual basis by these tropical storms and tropical cyclones, and all the signs suggest that they're getting more and more serious. And we've seen this time Freddy going back and forth, some projections even suggesting that it will bounce back for another pass. So the people of Mozambique, you know, really bearing the brunt of climate change here, to which they've really contributed very little.
How much does climate change come up in conversation in Mozambique?
It comes up a lot, certainly, and it's something which UNICEF and which the UN and which the government are certainly paying attention to. Mozambique is one of the countries most vulnerable to climate change. It has a very long coast, more than 2,000 kilometers long, and many of the cities are located on the eastern seaboard in very low-lying areas. So we, for example, do a lot of work in ensuring climate resilience of our programming. So, for example, we construct schools which can stand up to this kind of tropical storm cyclone, which won't get blown down as had previously been the case, and making sure that healthcare centres and health facilities are also built to withstand this kind of impact. But it really is a challenge, and it's very difficult for a country like Mozambique to be resilient against such a constant barrage of climate impacts.
UNICEF spokesperson Guy Taylor in Maputo, Mozambique, describing the destructive force of Cyclone Freddy, the longest-lasting tropical cyclone on record. Guy, thank you for being with us.
Pleasure.
The U.S. and the U.K. are a year and a half into an agreement to sell nuclear-powered submarines to Australia. Yesterday, leaders of the three countries said they were making progress and intensifying their efforts. The submarines being sold to Australia are nuclear-powered. They do not carry nuclear weapons. Still, the sale raises concerns about long-established nuclear safeguards to prevent nuclear materials from getting into the wrong hands. To talk this through, we reached out to James Acton. He's co-director of the Nuclear Policy Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Washington.
The problem is that Australia is a non-nuclear weapon state. It's a signatory to the Non-Proliferation Treaty as a non-nuclear weapon state. And so it's obliged to place all of its nuclear material under the inspection regime of the International Atomic Energy Agency. The challenge is that the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, cannot properly inspect nuclear material when it's on a submarine. The locations of those submarines are secret. The IAEA can't simply come along and inspect it. And so the safeguards agreement with the IAEA does actually provide a specific exemption by which a state like Australia can exempt nuclear materials from safeguards. And Australia is going to use that exemption. And as such, it's going to become the first non-nuclear weapon state ever to use that exemption. And in my view, that sets a very troubling precedent. I want to be very clear. I do not think Australia is going to misuse this nuclear material. I don't think Australia is going to develop nuclear weapons. But I worry that other states with more nefarious goals are going to invoke the Australia precedent and in the future may also withdraw nuclear material from safeguards. And they may use it to manufacture nuclear weapons rather than to power nuclear submarines. So this is what I mean by the troubling precedent that I'm concerned AUKUS will set.
The Chinese foreign minister today said the partners in this collaboration, the U.S., the U.K. and Australia, demonstrate that for the sake of their own geopolitical interests, completely disregard the concerns of the international communities and are walking further and further down the path of error and danger. Would you agree?
Well, look, a lot of what the Chinese government has said is factually wrong. I mean, the Chinese government has said that AUKUS is a violation of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. That is just not true. There are specific terms in the safeguards agreement that clearly allow this exemption. The Chinese government has also said that we're going to be supplying Australia with nuclear weapons. That's not true. But the basic point that this does contradict basic non-proliferation principles that the UK and the US have argued for many years, I think, is true in this case. The UK and the US have long resisted non-nuclear weapon states from operating naval reactors precisely because you can't do that while maintaining nuclear material under safeguards. The UK and the US, they're not in any way unresponsive to non-proliferation concerns, and they're trying their best to mitigate this non-proliferation precedent. But I disagree with the UK Prime Minister when he says that AUKUS will strengthen non-proliferation. I think it's more the case that the steps the UK and the US are taking will make the precedent less bad, but withdrawing nuclear material from safeguards, which you're allowed to do, but is still a bad precedent, in my opinion.
Eventually, Australia will be building its own nuclear-powered subs. How will that change the threat, at least as it would be seen by China?
Look, China doesn't like this, you know, in exactly the same way that we don't like it when China develops capabilities that can undermine our interests. You know, that's the difficult security situation in the Asia Pacific here. And a lot of what China is saying in response to that is, you know, it's pretty disingenuous lies, to be frank, because it's looking for any means to marshal international support to try and derail this program. So in that sense, you know, I think the Chinese government statements on this are pretty disingenuous and unfair. On the other hand, I do think there are some very legitimate real non-proliferation concerns about this program.
James Acton is with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He was helping us understand the concerns about the U.S. and the U.K. partnering with Australia with the new deal around nuclear-powered submarines. James, thanks very much.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
It's often said taking care of the family and home is the hardest job of all. In Spain, a judge probably agrees with that. A Spanish court awarded a divorced mother back pay for 25 years of service to her family. The woman had sued her ex-husband after he left her with nothing. The court's decision was actually based on a law that's been on the books for more than 40 years. From Barcelona, Jerry Haddon has more.
Ivana Moral married young, age 20. At the time, she figured, this is it. I've met the other half of my orange, as they say in Spanish, my life partner.
A los 20 días de casarme, lo pasamos a firmar ante notario.
But Moral says, after 20 days of marriage, my husband had me sign a separation of assets agreement. That basically says, what's yours is yours, what's mine is mine. Whether we're married or divorced, nothing gets shared, not even after death.
Sorprendió un poco porque... Bueno, no había razón.
I was kind of surprised, Moral says. We'd just tied the knot. I'd assumed we'd be sharing everything. For the next 25 years, Moral says she and her husband built a small empire of fitness clubs in the south of Spain. She hosted events, became a fitness instructor, even mopped floors, all without a salary. Along the way, she kept up the family house, then stayed home for years to raise two daughters. In 2020, the Morals divorced. Ivana Moral walked away from the marriage with zilch. A big goose egg, not even alimony, all because of that separation of assets agreement. Everything was in her husband's name, including the chain of gyms, then worth several million dollars. Sound harsh? It is, says University of Barcelona law professor Chantal Moy de Alba.
Of course, this is a tough system because you can become completely poor.
De Alba says many European countries have separation of assets clauses by default in their marriage laws, from the UK to Greece. That's why back in 1978, the European Union told member states, hey, this isn't fair at all. Divorce, it said, should not leave stay-at-home spouses penniless.
And so that's why in Spain, the civil code was modified that in case of divorce or death, the judge is able to compensate the part of the couple which worked for the other party.
That's what the judge in this case did last week, awarding Ivana Moral about $190,000. The formula for compensation, the number of years of marriage times Spain's annual minimum wage. The decision has Moral elated, her ex-husband appealing, and it's made headlines across Europe.
Vamos, está sonando mi teléfono.
My phone's now ringing like crazy, says Moral's attorney, Marta Fuentes. Some callers think I have a magic wand, she says. Fuentes is wondering why the Moral case has made headlines at all, given that the compensation law has been on the Spanish books for more than four decades, and it's been used a lot. Fuentes thinks local journalists pushed the story hard because the decision coincided with International Women's Week. But Professor de Alba says separation of assets clauses are rare in Spain these days, except for in the northeast region of Catalonia. So yeah, in Spain's deep south, this probably was news to lots of people.
It's quite amazing, but maybe it's a good news that journalists pay attention to this, no? Because this way society is more aware of the different rights they have.
The spotlight on the Moral case has also rekindled a larger discussion about what value societies place on the work of unpaid spouses. To date, only a handful of countries have taken concrete measures. In Venezuela, in 2007, the government of Hugo Chavez set an official, if short-lived, wage for housewives. Last year, a judge in Kenya ordered homemakers to be paid a salary, but that hasn't been implemented yet. And in 2021, a court in China awarded a divorced stay-at-home mom compensation for years worked. It was a first under Chinese law, though the sum was symbolic, just under $8,000. As for the U.S., there is no precedent for paying a wage to homemakers, whether married or divorced. But as Professor de Alba says, prenups rule the day stateside. They may be less than romantic, she says, but knowing what's yours and what isn't is the best way to tie the knot. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon in Barcelona.
It is The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. If you've ever spent any time in a tropical country, you might be familiar with dengue fever. It's a mosquito-borne disease that makes you really sick for several days, sometimes for weeks. It can also cause serious health complications. And this year, there's a troubling sign. There have been more cases of dengue fever than usual. The World's TBS Isaiah reports.
It's been raining a lot in Santa Cruz, the biggest city in Bolivia. And mosquitoes love rain because they lay their eggs in stagnant water. Oliver Bernal is an emergency doctor in Santa Cruz.
Hay un cúmulo muy importante de agua en las avenidas o agua estancada dentro de los domicilios, llantas.
He says stagnant water collects everywhere, in the streets, in everyday objects like kids' toys and tires. It's even found in people's houses. Bolivia is going through its worst dengue outbreak in decades, with close to 15,000 cases, and 80% of them are in Santa Cruz.
Pero en esta oportunidad hemos sido completamente rebasados en los hospitales que ya están colapsados.
Bernal says medical centers are at capacity, and the government has had to open field hospitals to help treat patients. Every year during the rainy season, Bolivian health officials inspect homes looking for potential breeding sites for mosquitoes. But this year, the fumigation process got started late.
Debido a conflictos sociales, ya no se ha procedido a realizar las fumigaciones correspondientes.
Bernal says political turmoil in recent months prevented authorities in Santa Cruz from completing the fumigation process on time. Also, during the pandemic, he says health authorities had to focus on COVID, and they neglected dengue prevention programs in many areas. This dengue outbreak is not exclusive to Bolivia. It's happening in Peru, where authorities declared a health emergency a few weeks ago. And in Brazil, dengue is spreading in areas that, until recently, were free of the disease. In fact, in the last 5 years, almost 500 Brazilian municipalities have detected dengue for the first time. Yves Mauro Fernandes, a public health researcher at the Federal University of Goiás in Brazil, says climate change has a lot to do with that.
Tem chovido mais nos últimos anos na América do Sul.
He says temperatures are warming and there's been more rain in a lot of places. Nilika Malagive is the head of a global program that works on dengue fever. She's based in Colombo, Sri Lanka.
What we have seen is actually more virulent viruses or strains of dengue are evolving to cause this devastation.
She says finding a treatment for dengue has been challenging.
Because it is affecting these low-income or low-middle-income countries, adequate funding has not been available for a treatment.
This year, there have also been high numbers of dengue cases in India, Laos, Malaysia, and the Philippines. But Malagive says dengue is not a problem exclusive to tropical countries anymore. Last year, with heat waves in Europe, there were reported cases of dengue in France and Italy. And just last week, Spanish authorities warned of an outbreak in popular tourist destinations, including Ibiza and Mallorca.
High-income countries are not safe from dengue anymore because of this climate change and also because of more intense transmission in dengue endemic countries.
No dengue vaccine has yet to be approved globally. And without consensus on what works, she says the worsening situation in Bolivia is a sign of what's to come elsewhere.
So it's everybody's problem. So all of us have to come together, act, and find a treatment for dengue.
For the world, I'm Tibisay Sea.
The International Criminal Court is making a big move. It plans to open two war crimes cases related to Russia's invasion of Ukraine, the first international criminal charges levied pertaining to the war. The cases will involve issuing arrest warrants for several people, according to Reuters and the New York Times. For more, Rebecca Hamilton joins me. She's a professor of law at American University, where she focuses on international law. She joins us today from Berkeley, California. How significant is this announcement, Rebecca?
This is a huge development that many people have been waiting for, knowing that the International Criminal Court has been investigating these crimes since the start of the war.
Do we know yet who actually is being charged?
No, we don't know who arrest warrants are being issued for. The most information that we have at the moment is the content broadly of the two cases that are forthcoming. And one case is going to be looking at the deportation of Ukrainian children into Russian territory. And the other case is going to be focused on the targeting of civilian infrastructure, the kind of infrastructure that enables civilians to access water or gas, things that are not military targets and should be protected even in the midst of an armed conflict.
How hard is it going to be to collect evidence for the damage against civilian infrastructure in Ukraine?
So what we call crime-based evidence, the evidence that the infrastructure itself has been damaged by Russian weaponry, is very easy at this point. There is a lot of documentation. The challenge always with these cases is that you've got to link it to the specific perpetrators. So that linkage evidence that takes you from the devastation that you see on the ground up to who was it that actually ordered that destruction.
If we just look at the deportation of Ukrainian children, some of them orphans reportedly adopted by Russians, what kind of evidence exists to take that case on?
A lot of the media attention on this situation came to light with the publication of a report by something called the Yale Humanitarian Research Lab that looked at what we call user-generated evidence, so material that users in Ukraine and in Russia were posting on social media, photographs, other messages. They got information from Telegram, and they triangulated that information with satellite imagery, pulling together the geolocation data to track where these children were being moved to.
And what does the road ahead look like for both these two cases? Are we likely to see either of them enter into a courtroom?
So this is always the challenge with international criminal justice, is the length of time that it takes. It would be relatively easier to get the so-called foot soldiers responsible for these war crimes, easier to apprehend them and to bring them to trial in The Hague, much more difficult as you get further up the chain of command to those who are actually responsible for the policies that underlie the commission of these crimes.
And what does that mean for the likelihood that people who have committed war crimes will actually be held accountable?
I'm very confident that in the long run, we are going to see accountability in this situation, probably more than any other situation of atrocity that I've seen in my career. We have such a robust set of accountability resources being brought to bear in this situation.
The ICC has been trying international criminal cases for a long time now, but the slam dunks are few and far between. Why is that?
The ICC has struggled for a long time now with a lack of resources to match the incredibly powerful mandate that it has. It has the remit to go after those most responsible for the worst crimes that are committed, and yet it doesn't have the resources to support that work. And I think what we're seeing in the Ukraine situation is a renewed interest by states in making sure that the ICC is funded and resourced and equipped.
Rebecca Hamilton is a professor of law at American University, where she focuses on international law. She joined us from Berkeley, California. Rebecca, thank you very much for being with us today.
Always my pleasure.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. Twenty years ago, the U.S. invaded Iraq. A writer from Baghdad talks about his life since then, how Iraqis turned against each other after shock and awe became open civil war.
Suddenly, within 2 years, I became a stranger in my own city because I couldn't travel across the city as a local, as a Baghdadi, as an Iraqi.
One man's life before and after Saddam, still ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Falling in love is supposed to happen like a lightning bolt, free and uncluttered. But the truth is, romantic relationships are not so easy. And finding love in a place where there are missile strikes, air raid sirens, power outages, and curfews, like Ukraine? Good luck. The World's Carolyn Beeler looked into this and has our story in three chapters.
Chapter 1. Dating. Yevhen Martinenko walks into a bar in Kyiv. It's the kind of place where he might normally go on a date, but he's alone.
When the war started, everything has changed.
He had a girlfriend not long ago, but like millions of Ukrainians, she moved away from home at the beginning of the war to be safer.
This kind of distance, it was very bad for our relationship.
They broke up last spring. Yevhen is a tall, serious history student at a local university. In normal times, he'd have plenty of places to meet single women.
Before the war had started, I had got a job. I was studying at university. I was visited a lot of nightclubs, maybe some pubs, bars.
But he lost his restaurant job when the place closed when the war started. School went online, and many clubs shut down because there's an 11 p.m. curfew.
For me, it became more difficult to meet with some new people.
Last summer, he downloaded Tinder and another dating app called Badoo. But he says he hasn't had much luck on the apps.
It's very difficult to me to build a new relationship when you meet a person online.
He hopes when the war ends, he'll have better luck dating in person. Until then, he leaves the bar, still alone, to get home before curfew. Chapter 2, Moving In Together. Alina Beretsova and Stanislav Linievich had better luck on Tinder, where they matched last summer. That's Archie, a chubby beagle mix, greeting me when I show up at their place. Alina, who works in IT, says the dog was the first thing in Stas's profile that caught her eye.
I remember that I saw Archie in pictures.
On a more serious note, Stas, who works for a humanitarian organization, says the war is what motivated him to sign up for Tinder in the first place.
Russians want to grab our territory, kill our people. So we need to live, we need to love, because only good things can defeat that darkness.
The couple is sitting on their couch as snow falls outside their apartment tower in the suburbs of Kyiv. Alina jokes that Stas brought out the heavy artillery on the first date, both flowers and the dog.
I took Archie for our first date. Yeah.
We walk all evening, yep.
Buy some flowers, and then we were speaking a lot.
They talked for hours, and by the time they realized what time it was...
Whoa, it's already 10:30 p.m.
They had just half an hour to get home before curfew. Alina issues just one correction to the first date story.
So actually, I was only listening to you. You speak a lot in the first date. I listen in it and...
The jab is loving. They're adorably into each other. His hand is on her knee while they sit on the couch. She picks some fuzz out of his buzz cut. They say their relationship moved fast. After 6 weeks of dating, she decided to move into his place. With Russian missiles targeting infrastructure, the air raid sirens, the power outages, it was reassuring, Alina says.
I didn't have water in my flat, I didn't have light, and it was scary for me. And when I was with Stanislav, it was more comfortable and more calm for me.
Alina told me sometimes that she feels much safeness when we're together, and for me, it was very important to support her and to be near her in such stress moments.
After we talk, Alina and Stas head out of their apartment building to take Archie for a walk.
Archie!
They say making long-term plans right now is hard, but they hope soon to find a new apartment together, closer to green space where they can walk Archie. Chapter 3. Getting married. Anna Panasenka is pacing in the lobby of a municipal wedding chapel in Kyiv. She's in her gown, flawless makeup and hair, telling her fiancé over the phone in only slightly exasperated tones how to get here. When her fiancé arrives and introduces himself, he's downright giddy.
My name is Max.
How are you feeling right now? Excited?
I'm happy. So happy.
Max is Max Protsik. The couple is in their 20s, met 2 years ago at a party held illegally during a COVID lockdown, and got engaged 6 months ago. Through an interpreter, they say at first they thought of postponing the wedding, hoping the war would end soon. But as it dragged on, they decided to go for it.
We don't want
to postpone our life, especially because the war is happening. We don't want to postpone our life. We have to keep on living. And amongst all this evil that is happening, we want, and she added, some good in our lives.
Friends posing with them for photos say the couple supporting each other through the stress of war has brought them closer together. She works in a beauty salon. He works in construction. Max says he plans to help rebuild the country as they build a new life together. In the chapel, Anna walks down the aisle in a floor-length gown with a plunging neckline and lace overlay. It's a very different look than the bride just before her. She was in camo pants, combat boots, and a traditional Ukrainian tunic. There's been a boom in military couples taking their vows here, even coming straight from the front lines. And it's official. as Anna and Max have their first kiss as a married couple. His mother, Arina Protsik, reflects on how far removed this feels from life in her village outside of Zaporizhia. It's about 10 miles from the front lines and where Max grew up. It's a big contrast, she says. Soldiers are constantly passing through their village, helicopters flying overhead, explosions sounding in the distance. At a toast after the ceremony, the newly hitched couple is all smiles, bubbling over like the champagne in their flutes. Max told me earlier, though, that the war is still on the couple's minds, even on their wedding day. But this moment is about celebrating their love and a new beginning.
The World's Carolyn Beeler is still with us and joins me for a wider view of love in a time of war. Carolyn, you also spoke with a couple's counselor in Kyiv, right?
That's right. I spoke with psychologist Tatiana Lipchinska, who's treated hundreds of people since the full-scale invasion started last year. And she told me that the stress and terror of war is a litmus test for many couples that she sees.
Some couples, they are getting even stronger and they have some obstacles and problems. But now, this context of war, they made this couple realize that it's very important to have this relationship and they get closer.
But she says for some other couples, war can drive them apart.
All these scenes that were deeply inside, they come to surface and we can see these changes in relationships.
Lipchinska told me that marriages were up about 20% last year in Ukraine, but divorces increased even more than that.
And I think about refugees and internally displaced people. How much is distance a factor, Carolyn? Because the first guy you spoke with, and the story we just heard, when his girlfriend moved away, the couple split up. How common is that right now in Ukraine?
Lipchinska sees distance as the biggest contributor to wartime breakups, which is intuitive, right? Millions of people left the country after the full-scale invasion started. Long-distance relationships are always hard. But she pointed out couples are also dealing with the trauma of either living through a war or being displaced and sometimes don't have the emotional energy to tend to their relationships.
If you don't invest and if you don't flourish relationship, sooner or later they will die, unfortunately.
Yeah, right. I mean, relationships are tough. They need constant nourishment, that investment of time and care. Are a lot of couples speeding up the commitment timeline, like that couple you met who decided to move in together after just 6 weeks?
Yeah, Lipchinska told me she was seeing more of that with the couples that she sees in therapy because of this search for stability that Alina and Stas talked about, but also
because people understand that we don't have tomorrow, we have now.
Carolyn, I gather the push for same-sex marriage in Ukraine has also picked up some energy during the war. Talk about that briefly.
Right. It's currently illegal, but the war has raised the concern that same-sex partners might not be able to visit an injured soldier in the hospital, for example, or even claim a body. So a petition calling for same-sex marriage to be legalized landed on President Zelensky's desk this summer. He then raised civil unions as a possibility instead, and a Ukrainian lawmaker submitted a draft law to parliament just last week that would establish civil unions. So we'll see where that goes.
The World's Carolyn Beeler on love in a time of war in Ukraine. Thanks very much. This is fascinating.
You're welcome, Marco.
The political opposition in Italy has a new leader, and just like the current prime minister, Elly Schlein is the first woman elected to her role. But the two politicians are polar opposites. Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni comes from the far right. Schlein is a U.S.-Italian national who cut her political teeth volunteering on Barack Obama's first election campaign. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry has her story.
On the night Elly Schlein was elected leader of Italy's Democratic Party, her supporters burst into song. The tune is an old Italian folk song. It's also a famous anti-fascist resistance anthem. Elly Schlein has been compared to US Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. She's the youngest person to ever lead Italy's Democratic Party and the first woman. And on the night of her election, it didn't take Schlein long to name check the other female leader dominating Italian politics right now.
Noi abbiamo un dovere da domattina. Saremo un bel problema per il governo di Giorgia Meloni.
Starting tomorrow morning, we will be a big problem for Giorgia Meloni's government, she said. The two leaders could not be more different. Giorgia Meloni, the Nationalist Prime Minister, was raised by a single mother in a working-class neighbourhood of Rome. And being a mother and a Christian is something she talks about a lot.
Io sono Giorgia! Sono una donna! Sono una madre! Sono italiana! Sono cristiana! Non me lo toglierete! Non me lo toglierete!
I am Giorgia. I'm a woman. I'm a mother. I'm Italian. I'm a Christian. And you can't take that away from me, she famously said in 2019. Elie Schlein took a dig at Meloni's rhetoric on the campaign trail last year.
Sono una donna. Amo un'altra donna. E non sono una madre, ma non per questo sono meno donna.
I'm a woman. I love another woman. And I'm not a mother. But that doesn't make me any less of a woman, she said. Schlein is openly bisexual. She was brought up in an upper-middle-class family in Switzerland. And although her father is Jewish, she says she wasn't raised in the religion. Giorgia Meloni called Schlein to congratulate her on her election success. But political experts say Elie Schlein could prove to be a real threat to the far-right prime minister.
She has kind of stolen some of the attention that Meloni had attracted.
Cecilia Emma Sotelotta is a political science professor at University in Perugia. She says Giorgia Meloni became prime minister at a time when it wasn't clear what the opposition stood for.
I think that Meloni's victory was partly due to her ability to convince the electorate, but also because there was a total inability of the left to unite and come up with a solid, convincing narrative about who they were and what their vision for the country was.
Sotelotta says Schlein is very clear about what she believes in. On her agenda, tackling poverty, investing in a greener economy, campaigning for the LGBTQ community and migrant rights. Schlein's first trip after winning the party leadership was to Calabria and the site of a shipwreck where more than 70 migrants died a few days earlier en route from Turkey. Schlein has called on the country's interior minister to resign over comments he made suggesting the migrants were to blame for the tragedy. Elie Schlein's political rise has got a lot of attention in the Italian press. They've called her everything from a communist, a radical,
anticapitalista, ecologista, terzomondista, utopista, ma anche europeista,
as well as an anti-capitalist, privileged, and a friend of Israel's. Schlein says the comments stink of anti-Semitism and homophobia. But there's been a backlash from her own party too. One founding member has already resigned, saying the Democratic Party has moved too far to the left. Still, some experts say it's a shake-up that the left-wing party desperately needs.
In the last election, Democrats lost millions of voters, maybe because they were not recognizable anymore as a centre-left party.
Mattia Diletti lectures at La Sapienza University in Rome. He says Giorgia Meloni is such a radical figure on the right that the left need an outspoken leader on the opposite end of the political spectrum.
I think the public needs something more radical, and the Democratic voters look for something more radical because the entire political system is more radical than a few years ago.
Right now, the Democratic Party is polling at just around 17%. Still, in a country where more than two-thirds of lawmakers are men, having two women in the top political jobs is already a big change, and one that many say is long overdue. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
The US consulate in Lahore, Pakistan, has a Twitter feed that tells you how the air quality is there. When you scroll through it, you'll see a pattern. The days read like this: unhealthy, unhealthy, unhealthy. Day after day, week after week. A new study by a Swiss air purifier manufacturer confirms this. It found that last year Lahore was the world's most polluted metropolitan area on Earth. It's not hard to understand why when you watch online videos of the roads in Lahore slammed with traffic. Clogged roads, though, that's only strike one. Strike two, industrial pollution from factories. In this video on Twitter, an official with Lahore's anti-smog squad, yep, that's a thing there, they look upwards skeptically at a tall factory furnace. The job of the anti-smog squad is to temporarily close factories that spew too much smoke, which is usually a result of relying on low-quality fuel. Then strike three. In the fall and winter, there's what's called stubble burning and more smoke. This happens at the end of the harvest season. Farmers across Pakistan burn the stalks and other debris left over from their crops, all to prepare the farmland for the next season. The problems in Lahore are similar to cities in neighboring India. Those urban areas dominated the worst ranked in the Swiss air purifier study. 14 of the world's 20 most polluted cities are in India. The second smoggiest city on the list, Hotan, China. Things are improving there, and despite China's reputation for smog, Hotan was the only Chinese city to crack the top 20 in the Swiss survey. Looking at countries as a whole, Chad and Iraq had the worst average air quality for an entire nation. Pakistan ranks third worst. As for good air, that honor goes to the U.S. territory of Guam. Last year, people on the island in the Pacific enjoyed the best measured air quality on the planet. This week, 20 years ago, March 17, 2003, then-President George W. Bush told Saddam Hussein to step down or else. 48 hours later, the U.S.-led bombing campaign in Iraq began. That was known as Shock and Awe.
Now, this is what it looked and sounded like in Baghdad. On my orders, coalition forces have begun striking selected targets of military importance to undermine Saddam Hussein's ability to wage war.
At the time, Gaith Abdul Ahad was a young architect working in Baghdad. With his home city suddenly in the center of the war, Abdul Ahad ditched architecture and took jobs as a translator and interpreter for journalists, and later as a journalist himself. He went on to chronicle what he calls the unbuilding of Baghdad. Abdul Ahad's new book is a rare account of the invasion, and the years that followed is seen through Iraqi eyes. It's called A Stranger in Your Own City, Travels in the Middle East Long War. Gaith, good to speak with you again. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Marco. Very good to talk to you again.
Your book begins actually before the invasion in this centuries-old cosmopolitan city where you grew up. Just take us to the Baghdad neighborhoods you knew as a kid and as a young man. What did they look like and sound like?
Well, Marco, I mean, I lived all my life in Baghdad. I rarely left the city. And I have to confess, Baghdad is an ugly city. It's flat. It has no horizon. But the old part of the city, that's where a whiff of the stories of the Abbasid, the 1000 Night and Night, you can see it, you can feel it in the packed alleyways and these wooden windows. So you can still feel the old Baghdad. But the rest of the city was just flat, big. Mm. Later, these characterless neighborhoods will come to have a very distinctive character and a very distinctive sectarian identity.
All of Iraq at that time was under the thumb of the supreme leader, a man known as the savior, the inspirer, the victorious. I'm talking, of course, about Saddam Hussein. You call him the leader necessity. Explain the origins of that phrase.
He had probably more than 99 titles, and he ruled our lives. And for a long time, when I was a child, I confused Saddam with this kind of superhero from Japanese cartoons and God himself. And the narrative in the 70s and 80s was Iraq was this country of 5,000 years of civilization. It starts with the Babylonian Assyrians, goes through the Arab conquerors, and then the latest manifestation of the greatness is Saddam. This is how he was portrayed. I mean, you open the notebook, you see his pictures. You go to the school, you see his pictures. You switch on the TV, you see him talking to you. He was everywhere.
In March of 2003, of course, came the American-led invasion, the second Gulf War. You viewed it in the night sky from your rooftop, huddled under a carpet. During the day, you were cycling through the deserted streets of Baghdad and saw this war. As those first bombs fell, Gaith, can you remember what was going through your mind?
Of course, there is the shock, the fear, the anxiety. Where are these bombs are going to fall? Are they as smart as the Americans claim? I don't think I or anyone I talked to at the time believed that Saddam would be toppled so quickly in 2-3 weeks. So yes, I was cycling through the city during the day, but mainly to witness the destruction from an architectural perspective.
I'm speaking with writer Gaith Abdul Ahad, author of the new memoir, A Stranger in Your Own City. In your reporting, you meet and travel with many of the armed militants fighting over Baghdad and all of Iraq. You describe one of them, Hamid, as, quote, the first of many people who protected me in 2 decades of civil war, end quote. He's Sunni, previously allied with Saddam Hussein and a former military officer. He has a law degree. Why did a man like this become an al-Qaeda ally and a militant commander?
On the heels of this American occupation, the city became divided. Suddenly, certain neighborhoods became controlled by Sunni insurgents. Others were controlled by Shia militiamen. And a civil war started by this tit-for-tat killing. Men like Hamid, it's the natural progress of, you know, his mindset to move from being a military, who hated Saddam, by the way, because he accused Saddam of doing so many things horrible to the Iraqi people. But he's found himself to have to fight. And at one point, he was fighting in the same trench with Al-Qaeda against the Americans. But quickly on, he realized that people like Al-Qaeda, their extremist sectarian politics, was going to lead to the defeat of his people, which, of course, that's what happened eventually.
Hmm. How did those years of turmoil transform Baghdad? When you go back, do you recognize what happened during that time?
You know, Marco, I started by saying that I am a local of Baghdad and I lived in the city for 28 years, rarely leaving it. But then suddenly within 2 years, I became a stranger in my own city because I couldn't travel across the city as a local, as a Baghdadi, as an Iraqi. I needed people to vouch for me because each neighborhood was run by a different armed group. I mean, I would drive through neighborhoods that I knew very well. I couldn't recognize because of all the barricades, the concrete walls, the militiamen standing in the street. It turned from your own city into a war zone.
Some 2,500 U.S. troops remain in Iraq, advising and training Iraqi troops. How do Iraqis feel about the presence of those Americans and just generally about the 2003 American-led invasion?
If you ask Arab people in the streets today, they would tell you, oh, we blame America for bringing this corrupt political elite that we have now, for turning Iraq into this kind of country run by militia commanders, kleptocratic politicians. In 2003, people were very happy to get rid of Saddam. They were not happy to be occupied. The occupation was ugly from the beginning. In 2019, there was these massive demonstrations in the street. The youth, a new generation, grew up in the war, a generation that didn't remember Saddam. And the rallying cry of those people were, A, we want a homeland, because they wanted the country back. Two, they were cursing both Iran and America, because they hold these two countries responsible for the destruction that befallen Iraq in the past 2 decades. I mean, of course, the roots of the civil war lay earlier, probably in the 90s and the 80s, but they hold America responsible for destroying something and then handing it to a bunch of thieves and militia commanders.
When you look 10 years into the future, Gabe, will Iraq and Baghdad especially still be fraught with that question of, was overthrowing Saddam Hussein, given all the uncertainty that's risen out of that act, was it worth it?
You know, Iraqis deserve something better than a mad dictator and illegal occupation. Iraq is a very wealthy nation. We're talking about $100, $120 billion worth of oil money per year. And yet certain parts of Baghdad, let alone certain parts of the country, are so impoverished. They're on par of some of the poorest countries in the world. This is the crisis of Iraq. It's an environmental crisis with the rivers drying. It's a social crisis. The corruption in Iraq is worse than any threat facing Iraq in the past 20 years, even worse than ISIS, because you have $20-30 billion siphoned every year. And that is creating so much anger that will eventually explode and lead to another round of violence unless it's addressed now.
Gaith Abdullahad's new book is called A Stranger in Your Own City, Travels in the Middle East, Long War. Gaith, really good to speak with you again. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you so much, Marco. Thank you.
The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Thanks for being with us. We'll see you again tomorrow.